Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DeMattei. Tom Hudson is out this week. Florida lawmakers had to cut short their summer vacations yesterday and go into special session. Exactly a week from today is the cutoff date for the Florida legislature to redraw new congressional voting maps to replace those a Leon County judge declared unconstitutional just last month. On the line with us is Gina Jordan, WLRN Tallahassee reporter, and Steve Bosquet from the Tampa Bay Times. Hello to you both.
Yes, hi there.
Hello.
Now, Steve, what happened? Oy vey, what brought us here just when we thought it was safe to go back into the voting booth?
Well, what brought the legislature back was a decision by Terry Lewis, a circuit court judge in Leon County, Tallahassee, in which he found that the way the legislature drew two of the congressional districts in Florida directly violates the Florida Constitution, because since 2010 we've had language in there called the Fair District Amendments, approved by voters, which basically say that districts cannot be drawn to favor one political party or one candidate over another. Lewis struck down two districts. One is in northeast Florida, represented by Democrat Corinne Brown of Jacksonville, and one is in circling suburban Orlando, represented by Dan Webster, Republican. The legislature has been in session since yesterday afternoon. The House is still in committee right now, and basically they're preparing a floor vote probably on Monday of a revised map that makes minor changes to those two districts and five others.
Okay. Steve, let's talk about that district represented by Corinne Brown a second. This is one thing that initially confused me. Now, this is a very, very odd, snaky sort of district that goes from, correct me if I'm wrong, from Orlando up to Jacksonville, and there's a heavy concentration of African Americans in that district. So how does that unfairly favor the GOP?
I think Judge Lewis made the conclusion that there are more African American voters in that district than are necessary for African American voters to nominate and elect the candidate of their choice, and as a result, the district does not meet other constitutional requirements for compactness and contiguity and so forth. So it was drawn, the judge found, to favor Corinne Brown.
Okay.
And so that's what's at issue here. And so you're right, it goes from Jacksonville to Orlando. And one of the reasons, however, the legislature would defend the map is that the traditional historical settlement patterns of African Americans in Florida tend to follow areas along railroad tracks. They tend to be in more highly concentrated urban areas.
And in this case, the St. John's River, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. And so the district was drawn in such a way to capture a significant number of black voters in about eight or nine different counties.
Gina Jordan, there are two districts in dispute, so why then do other districts have to be redrawn?
Well, because those boundary lines have to be redrawn, and by default, several places will be directly impacted. So in this case, just based on the early maps that we've seen, it looks like seven districts will be impacted. But none of those districts are in South Florida. They're hoping they can keep all of the changes, Central Florida and in North Florida.
But the deadline for the redrawing of the maps is August 15. Judge Lewis, I do believe, is holding a hearing for the 20th, dangerously close to the August 26 primary. So how could this affect the primary?
Well, it could affect it. It really just depends on what the judge decides about when there should be a special election, if there should be one. The problem is that lawmakers are drawing these new maps with the idea that there will not be any special election until after November 4th. So we'll see what the judge has to say about that. In the meantime, you have absentee ballots that have already been mailed. A lot have already been sent back. And you have supervisors of elections who are possibly frantic, not knowing if they have to scramble before the August 26 primary.
And Gina, this week you interviewed Susan McManus. She's a political scientist at the University of South Florida. And you asked her about the prospect of the potential that there would be more lawsuits stemming from this redrawn congressional district case. Here's what Susan McManus had to say.
Many of the components of the Fair District Amendment actually do conflict with each other, because also part of the Fair District's amendment was that things would not be drawn to the detriment of minorities under the Federal Voting Rights Act. And it's why so many people do expect that this case will not be the end-all case. It leaves a lot of people feeling that there's not going to be a new resolution to this before the August 26th primary.
So let's rewind a second. For the districts that are being redrawn, what can voters expect in those counties?
They don't know. I mean, they literally do not know right now what will happen. The judge will have to decide whether the maps that are turned in are okay, and then decide whether there should be a special election. It seems really crazy to think that there could be anything that would happen before the August 26th primary. And Steve, you may have heard something different on this, but right now everything just seems to be up in the air.
Well, let me clarify one thing. This will not affect the election on August 26th or the general election. However, in other words, people will still go to vote in Corinne Brown's congressional district and Dan Webster's. However, there may be a special election in all of these seven congressional districts after November. And this is something that I've seen in news accounts this morning. The legislature said they would object to. But because in order to have an election, those deadlines begin weeks, if not months, before the election, when supervisors of election open qualifying for candidates, send out overseas and military ballots to Europe and other countries, start mailing out absentee voters, and so forth. So this could be an expensive and time-consuming burden for a lot of supervisors of election if there has to be special elections in all these congressional districts.
And Steve, I was just going to say, wherever lawmakers object, I make the assumption they go to court to object.
That's right. There also could be another lawsuit. There could be two other possibilities we haven't discussed. I'll be very brief. Number one, Circuit Judge Terry Lewis could reject this revised map by the legislature, which would start the process all over again. And there is likely to be possible legal action by a party that feels this answer by the legislature is still insufficient.
Steve Bosque from the Tampa Bay Times. Also, Gina Jordan, our WLRN Tallahassee reporter. Thank you.
Thank you.
Districts aren't the only realignment happening in Tallahassee. It appears that Governor Rick Scott wants to be the environmental governor. And he kicked off his Let's Keep Florida Beautiful tour this week. Joining us now is Tampa Bay Times reporter Craig Pittman, and he covers environmental issues for that paper. Craig, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for inviting me.
Now, what is Governor Scott's plan for the environment?
What he announced was that he wants to spend $1 billion on just about every aspect of Florida's environment, restoring the Everglades, cleaning up pollution in the Indian River Lagoon, restoring the state's declining springs, and trying to get tough on polluters, and also assuring a water supply for the state's continued growth.
Okay, and what kind of money is he pledging toward this end?
Well, it breaks down in a kind of an interesting way. He's talking about, for instance, spending $150 million a year on the Florida Forever land buying program, which some of your listeners may recall in 2011. He vetoed all of the money for Florida Forever and actually sort of campaigned on the idea of cutting waste. And to him, this seemed like waste. Now he's running for re-election and he's saying, I want to invest in this project once again.
Now, during a stop in Miami this week, the governor spoke publicly about his plan. Here's what he had to say.
With this unbelievable turnaround in our economy, we can make investments now. 620,000 private sector jobs have been added in 3.5 years. Thousands of people are moving here every year. We've got to make sure we invest wisely. And one of the most important things we can do is take care of our natural resources.
Now, Craig, it seems to me that he is tying his environmental plan to recovery. And job growth,
yes,
in Florida.
Yes, he's making the argument that, you know, before he had to focus on creating jobs, and now he has repaired the economy to the point where it's time to start putting some of the money back into these environmental programs. And you know, the environmental advocates that I've talked to say, boy, we really hope he means it, you know, if he gets reelected and this isn't just some reelection ploy.
Yeah, well, a number of them are calling it a gimmick. They don't take it seriously.
Right. Well, I mean, given sort of the history of Florida politics, that's understandable. It seems like politicians tend to care about the environment every 4 years or when they're running for election or re-election, and then they get into office and, you know, things aren't quite as important as they seem to be in the past. For instance, you know, one of the things the governor's very all-encompassing environmental plan doesn't mention is climate change, for instance, and that's a topic he's been criticized about repeatedly. So it'll be interesting to see if he attempts to move somewhat more toward the middle on that as well.
Now, at the same time, the governor's presumed Democratic challenger for the governor's race, Charlie Crist, what is his environmental plan?
He has talked a lot about solar power, wanting to get more invested in solar power. And in regards to Governor Scott, he says the big difference between them is he never approved drilling in the Everglades, which is kind of a cheap shot because, of course, the DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection, under every governor has said yes to every drilling permit in the Everglades area that has been applied for. However, now that one has become controversial in an election year, now suddenly the State Department of Environmental Protection is suing the driller, and it's become kind of a big cause down there. So, but prior to that, the DEP said yes to everything under every governor.
And just a reminder to our listeners, if you've got a question for Craig or any one of our other reporters, you can call 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. Craig, quickly, before we go, now Scott has laid out this plan. At the same time, there have been solar industry businesses who have been pleading with the governor. They say, give us enough time, public hearing time, to comment on some policies. Very briefly, what kinds of environmental projects is Governor Scott embracing, and what is he avoiding?
He's not talking about energy or climate change at all. He's not really even mentioning the idea of conserving energy, which a lot of energy advocates say is the cheapest form of energy, is trying to teach people how not to use quite so much power. He instead is talking about projects that would take, several of them he mentioned, would take 10 years, which of course, you know, he's running for re-election. He'd only be in office another four. So how do you tie the legislature into spending, continuing to spend on these projects for 6 years after he leaves office? You can't. You can't do that. And he's also talking about toughening penalties on polluters. At the same time, a group called Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility yesterday released a study that said pollution enforcement under the Scott administration has declined much further than it did under any previous governor. So it's almost as if he's saying, you know, don't look at my past record, look at what I'm promising to do for the future. And as you mentioned, he is leaving out some of the important issues.
Reporter Craig Pittman, he covers environmental issues for the Tampa Bay Times. Craig, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. Still to come, a group of local investigative reporters delves into the police-involved death of a graffiti artist and uncovers some disturbing facts about tasers and how they're used. Also, a look back at a pivotal moment in U.S.-Cuban relations. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMattei.
Es una injusticia.
It's an injustice with our family, with our community, with Colombia, because the justice in this country and any other country in the world should be fast and efficient and clear.
That's the father of Israel Hernandez speaking at a rally on Wednesday. It's been a year since his son, an 18-year-old graffiti artist, died in Miami Beach after being tasered by police. The case has sparked outrage nationwide and led to a lot of questions about the use of tasers as a law enforcement tool. With us in the studio is Stan Chigupowicz from Fusion. He's part of the investigative reporting team that produced a documentary titled Tasered, the Israel Hernandez Story. Stan, welcome.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Now, since Israel Hernandez's death last year, he used to go by Rifa, that was his street name. Mm-hmm. What have we learned about exactly what happened? What transpired?
Yeah, so basically he was, you know, tagging a wall in Miami Beach, 71st and Collins, and, you know, he was just pretty much doing that. He was an artist. He was a very, you know, at 18 years old, he was very accomplished, actually. He was tagging a wall, 1:30, 2 a.m., you know, Miami Beach, and he got caught by the police. They went on to go on a, you know, 10 to 15 minute foot chase. At that point, he got tasered, and he died in the spot. So, you know, at that point, obviously, you know, there was a lot of silence in the investigation. They didn't know exactly what was the cause of death. You know, they played around with the idea that, you know, he was on drugs and, you know, that maybe he had some kind of, you know, heart condition. But at the end, in March of this year, actually, it was the first time, and this is how, you know, this case is so important and so compelling because it was the first time in Florida that, you know, taser is the official cause of death.
And we're going to get to that in a second. Now, your documentary, when did you decide to do it, to shift gears from, you know, just examining Israel's death to the use of tasers?
Actually, it was interesting because, you know, August 7th of last year, we started, you know, working on it. You know, we felt that this was a really compelling case because, you know, the guy is an artist. He's an immigrant, too, which touched me, too. He's from Colombia. I'm from Venezuela. And Derek, who, you know, who I started this idea with, he's from Africa. So all of us are immigrants. So we started working on that, you know, from that day. And it was very interesting. And one of the things that we wanted to do is, you know, we knew that local channels and media in general was going to cover it as the news of the day kind of thing. But we really wanted to go much more deeper on the investigation. We started thinking that we were going to do the Israel Hernandez or Rifa story, but we found so many amazing information in the whole, you know, tasing world and the way it's used that we decided to just use this Israel Hernandez story as a device to tell a bigger story.
What do you think is the number one misconception that the general public has about tasers and how they're used by law enforcement?
Yeah, by far, it's that, you know, it's a weapon that it's non-lethal.
Non-lethal. You know, something. Part of your documentary includes John Burton, and he's an interesting fellow, one of only two lawyers in the country, you correct me if I'm wrong, to have won a wrongful death lawsuit against the taser's manufacturer, Taser International. And here's what John Burton had to say.
Police officers are told it's absolutely safe. They're in these training sessions. They're shocked in the back through alligator clips and so forth. See, it hurts like the Dickens, but everybody's fine right afterwards, ha-ha. And then they go out in the field and they do this to human beings, and people fall on curbs and have bad brain injuries, or all these other things happen to them, or it's just used for torture.
Now, on the tube, we've seen a lot of these demonstrations where you have these big burly guys holding another guy. The guy in the center gets tasered. And in this case, it looked like a group of Marines.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
And center guy gets tasered and his friends are holding him up. There's a lot of screaming. Then he falls. His friends, it's a controlled experiment. His friends, you know, put him down gently on the mat. Then he gets up. He's fine. Ha ha. Basically. But in the street, that's not what you discovered.
It doesn't happen like that. And you, if you get you know, an opportunity to see the documentary, you can you know, check it out in Fusion.net. You'll see that usually when people get tasered, I mean, they go straight to the floor. There's nothing you can do about it. I mean, you're being electrocuted, so you're going straight to the floor. And one of the things that we included in the documentary was actually, you know, the taser has enough electricity, you know, to take down a 2,000-pound bull. So if you apply this electroshock to a 120-pound person, which in this case that's what happened, I mean, it's going to cause problem. And if on top of that you tase this person in the chest area, that's obviously going to cause a big problem. In this case, death.
Okay, and about aim, we're going to discuss that a little later. You mentioned a few seconds ago the medical examiner's report in the Israel Hernandez case and how it is a first. Explain to us how it's a first.
So, yeah, it was here in Florida. It's the first time that, you know, it's the official cause of death is the taser. You know, they obviously try to play around with lots of different, you know, theories, you know, drug use, cocaine, maybe a previous condition, you know, cardiac condition that he and the family didn't know about. They played around with, you know, many different hypotheses. But at the end of the day, March 20th, it was March of this year for sure. It was, you know, finally the cause of death was the taser. And that's why, you know, it really made our investigation so much more important. So because, you know, maybe right now we're in a position to really make a change and to really create awareness, you know, for authorities and for people and for medical examiners, you know, to really reevaluate how tasers are being used.
Okay. And we have to clarify something. Israel Hernandez did not die on the spot. He was taken to a hospital immediately.
That's right. Yeah,
after he collapsed on the street, he was taken to a hospital.
That's correct.
Yeah, we do have to clarify that. So, Did you get a chance to speak to the CEOs of Taser International, the people who make this thing?
No, they wouldn't talk to us. They're not, you know, they don't really, they're not interested in doing, you know, interviews lately. You know, they did one a couple years ago with 60 Minutes. That didn't go, you know, too well. So they're not doing that. I mean...
And we do have a clip from a part of that 60 Minutes interview. This is Rick Smith. He is the CEO of Taser International. He is commenting on an Amnesty International report that said that since 2001, the number of deaths connected to tasers nationwide totaled 540. And this is Rick Smith reacting to that.
The vast majority of those, there is a clear other cause of death. It includes people who died of a cocaine overdose. If you neck it down to the cases where there is legitimate scientific debate that the taser may have caused the death, we're talking about less than 20, over a decade.
Okay, so first, if it's not, what are medical examiners saying is the cause when you've got a taser-related death? What do most medical examiners say has killed these people? 540 is a lot of people.
It has to do a lot with the area, with a target area. And we've seen, and we have a lot of video in the documentary in which we see, you know, an officer getting really close to the victim or the detainee and tasing him or her in the chest area. So that's going to cause problems. So, you know, that's the number one cause of deaths. You know, and also, you know, there's a really important fact, which is, you know, usually the tasers has to be used, you know, for one time, only one time, which is 5 seconds. And we've proven that, you know, that not always happens like that. I mean, we've seen cases that, you know, in 3 minutes they tased, you know, the victim for, you know, 9 times, and we have actually documentation to back it up. So, you know, that's it's. You know, it has to do a lot with the education of police officers that are using it in the wrong way.
Okay, here's the thing. Taser International 5 years ago recommended that police officers not aim for the chest. So, and a lot of police, I mean, how have police departments changed their policies, or have they?
They have not.
When it comes to aim, they're still aiming for the chest, presumably.
Yeah, they have not. And actually, you know, it's even more, you know, surprising the fact that they've been using it on kids. It, you know, we have a case on an 8-year-old girl who got tasered, you know, elderly, you know, older people who's getting tased. Actually, you know, we have a case in which, you know, a deaf person was doing something wrong. You know, he was deaf. You know, he didn't hear the police officer coming. And, you know, this person, you know, was tasered. So, you know, it's based on the fact that it's a non-lethal, you know, weapon. You know, it's being used very freely.
Stan Jakubowicz from Fusion. He's part of the investigative reporting team that produced a documentary titled Tasered, the Israel Hernandez Story, and you can find it on Fusion.net. Thanks so much, Stan.
Thank you.
Where were you in 1994? Libertad, libertad, liberty, liberty, freedom, freedom. Those are the chants of Cubans on Havana's seaside thoroughfare called Malecón. That was 20 years ago, captured on amateur video. At that time, Cubans took to the streets to protest the regime of Fidel Castro. Now, this was the first significant protest the country had ever seen and marked the beginning of a mass exodus. Fidel Castro told Cubans at that time, well, you know, you can leave if you want to, and leave they did. 35,000 rafters, or balseros, as they're called, fled the country and came to South Florida. In the studio with us is Tim Padgett, WLRN's Latin America editor. Tim, hello.
Hi.
And Miami Herald editor Nancy San Martin. The Herald and El Nuevo Herald are working on a series examining the Cuban rafter crisis and its aftermath. Tim, you were there.
Well, I was there after this all started, and it took us all by surprise. But the thing you have to remember about this crisis was that the summer of 1994, we were 3 years into what was called the special period in Cuba of the 1990s. The Soviet Union had collapsed in 1991, meaning Cuba had lost its most important lifeline. The Cuban economy was in practically a death spiral at that time. People were going hungry. And so in the August of 1994, the atmosphere was extremely ripe for rumors that Fidel and the Castro regime were going to let Cubans leave the island, much like they did during the 1980 Mariel boat lift. So when those rumors got hot enough, people started gathering on the Malecón, the Havana seawall, expecting boats to come and get them to take them to Miami and Florida.
It's striking. When you watch the amateur videos, you see just a couple of people milling about, kids going around on bicycles, and it starts to swell a little more, bit by bit. When did you get the first inkling that this was going to be something major?
Well, we started hearing reports that, you know, when people realized that, you know, no boats were coming for them, that's when all the frustrations about the special period and the poverty and the economic collapse began to boil over. And that's when the protests against the regime started. And you also started seeing things like Cubans hijacking ferry boats. And that's when Fidel, as he always did, got extremely angry at the United States, started blaming the Yankees, as he does for everything, and said, well, if all you Cubans want to go to the United States, go. And then what you saw was this massive effort by Cubans to build very innovative rafts. I mean, I spent a week or two just going up and down the coast watching people take lawnmower engines and creating these very innovative vessels that they use then to go across the straits.
But flimsy and dangerous.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, 35,000, Nancy, is a massive amount of people. Do we have a sense of how many people were lost?
Well, we were never able to, obviously, to confirm the number who didn't make it, but we do know that it was a significantly large number because many rafts were seen at sea that were empty. And the initial thought was that perhaps these were people that had been rescued by the Coast Guard, but indeed it turns out that many of these were believed to be people who just fell off the raft and didn't make it, because at the time, often when they were rescued, the Coast Guard would sink the rafts. The estimates are that for every three that made it, one did not. And remember that these rafts were filled with folks, you know, 3, 7, 10, sometimes 12, depending on the size.
Just a reminder for our listeners, if you'd like to ask our panel a question, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. Easy way to remember, 1-800-743-WLRN. Tim, 35,000, once again, it's just astounding, that amount of people. Were they housed in Guantanamo Bay when they managed to come over? What happened to them?
Well, a lot of them were processed and eventually were allowed to go to Florida. But again, the thing you have to remember, I mentioned before, the 1980 Mariel boat lift. There was no way the United States was going to let a repeat of that happen, because, you know, we're all very well here in Miami of how that affected Florida and the United States. So the Coast Guard and the U.S. government, the Clinton administration, were very aggressive, and I think Nancy would agree, in cutting off this flow. And unfortunately, as you mentioned, a lot of them didn't make it anyway. I mean, these were not very sturdy vessels. One day, a few colleagues and I, we chartered a boat to go out about 10 or 20 miles off the coast. And it was obvious that you could see that, you know, it's one thing to build a raft and sort of take off, you know, on the coast. But when you're about 25 miles out, the sea starts buffeting you very, you know, strongly. And it was obvious to us. We would talk, we would get up close to the rafts and we would ask people, do you really think you're going to make it?
Yeah, right.
And you could see suddenly the fear on a lot of their faces, that they knew, they realized at that moment that this, you know, no matter how well they'd built this raft, this was a lot more than they had, you know, bargained for.
And on the line, we have Chaz from Miami. He says that he volunteered at a rafter's house. Chaz, you're on the air.
I'm on the air?
Yes, you are.
Oh, wonderful. Hi.
Hi. What do you mean you volunteered at a rafter's house?
Yeah, my wife and I, well, at the time she was my fiance, I was teaching, and all the school teachers and the students brought in books, and I took some foodstuffs, books, and all sorts of things over to a rafter's house. It was a gentleman who actually had property at this home. And it was like a wayward house of people came over on rafts, and we would drop off the books. And I did a couple of trips. And it later became a museum of all these things that were done from, you know, pieces of... I mean, these were highly inventive and very resourceful people. And
Chaz, you mean that there were fragments of the boat there? What do you mean?
Well,
things were
fragments of the boats. And also later, after these people were you know, they were rounded up and they were sent to Guantanamo, and then later they were some were repatriated, others were allowed back in, if you remember. And then so the stuff that they left behind in Guantanamo, like billiard tables made out of cots and what they used to call marital cots, marital army cots. It would weld together two cots to create a marital bed. I just thought it was just testimony of the stuff that these people were made of. These were savvy people, and they were very resourceful, and I was very impressed by that. The reason why I'm calling is I've heard so many varying and conflicting statistics. I'd like to know if there's a count, and if so, how many people have actually perished trying to come over? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Chaz, thank you.
Well, that's what we were talking about before. I mean, the estimates vary. We know that thousands didn't make it just based on the number that did. Again, there's no way to quantify the exact number, but the estimate is that for every three rafts that made it, at least one did not.
And very quickly, we have to go. We have to take a break pretty soon. But one last question. How did this crisis have a lasting effect on immigration policy?
Well, it got the United States. Fidel was able to leverage then negotiations with the United States on clarifying immigration policy for Cubans. And the talks went on for a while. And a lot of the immigration policies now that you see between the United States and Cuba are a result of that crisis.
The name of the Miami Herald series is The Cuban Rafters, 20 Years After the Crisis. Our guests, Miami Herald's Nancy San Martin. Nancy, thank you.
Thank you.
And our own Tim Padgett. Always great to see you in here, Tim.
Always a pleasure, Signorina.
We need to take a short break. Just a reminder that we need to hear from you. Please call us with your questions and comments. The number to call is 1-800-743-9576. And you can always tweet us. Twitter handle is @WLRN. Still to come, from the Keys to the Palm Beaches, judges have ruled against Florida's same-sex marriage ban. We hear more about that, what that could mean for marriage equality here. And it's back to school time. Almost. We check in with our education reporter about what makes this school year different from years past. I'm Christine DiMatte, and this is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. A judge in Palm Beach County ruled against Florida's same-sex marriage ban on Tuesday. That means courts in all four South Florida counties have issued decisions against the state on this issue. With us in the studio, we have Jason Parsley. He's associate publisher of the South Florida Gay News. And on the line, we have Steve Rothaus, Miami Herald's Steve Rothaus. Hello, Steve.
Hi there. How are you, Chris?
Great. Jason, this most recent case out of Palm Beach County involved a winter home. Can you fill in the details?
Thank you, Chris. Basically, what happened is there was a couple. They owned a winter home in Boynton Beach, and one half of the couple passed away, and the other half wanted to be appointed as a personal representative. But because Florida does not recognize same-sex marriage, there was a legal battle, and the judge ruled that the Florida ban on gay marriage is unconstitutional.
Steve, how is this different from the rulings in the other three counties?
Well, the other three rulings, first the other two rulings in Miami-Dade and in the Monroe County cases, they were right-to-marry cases. These are couples who currently are partnered, but they want to get married, and so they have sued the clerks in both the Keys and in Miami-Dade County in order to be given marriage licenses. Now, the case in Broward, that was ruled on Monday. The law was declared unconstitutional by Judge Dale Cohn, and that was a case of a woman who is trying to end her civil union with a woman who she married. She had a civil union back in 2002, I believe. So she's trying to get unmarried, basically. And then, of course, the case in Palm Beach this week is another recognition case to recognize the marriage of these two men in Delaware. Now, they happen to be Pennsylvania residents, and they got married in Delaware shortly before first the partner died here in Boynton Beach, and then only a few months before Pennsylvania actually began to recognize gay marriage.
I think the other difference as well is that this case only applies to the facts of this case in Palm Beach. Mm-hmm. So there, it hasn't been appealed yet, and it's not expected to be appealed as the other cases have been by the Attorney General Pam Bondi.
Right. Well, the other thing is that, yes, I mean, that ruling in Palm Beach is specific to that particular case. The case in Broward, however, across the board, but in that case, Pam Bondi is not a defendant in that case. So she has not said whether she will appeal, but it's assumed that she will. In the case in Miami-Dade County and in Monroe County, she was the defendant along with the clerk, and so they had an automatic stay because she lost those cases.
Now, Jason, as associate publisher of the South Florida Gay News, I'm assuming you hear from a lot of other news outlets across the country. How closely is the rest of the country looking at what's happening in Florida right now? I mean, four counties in the course of about 3 weeks. That's a lot.
Well, every time there's a ruling anywhere in the country, it becomes news across the LGBT media spectrum. So, you know, Monroe, Miami-Dade, Broward, and now Palm Beach is definitely making the news.
Now, in all of these, well, at least one of these cases, one of the judges said that this ban is unconstitutional. Steve Rothaus, in 2008, we had Amendment 2, and at that point, marriage was defined as a union between one man and one woman only. About, you correct me if I'm wrong, about 60% of Florida
62.
Voters said 62%.
Right,
we're down with
the
that.
The threshold was 60%. In order to change the Constitution, you need a supermajority of 60% plus one.
So, you know, the question a lot of people are asking is, you know, what's up with the changing tide? I mean, how could it be unconstitutional now and, you know, perfectly constitutional back then? Well, in other words, where were all these people like in 2008?
Well, keep in mind that back in 2008, it was never declared to be constitutional. But back in 2008, if you remember, that's when California's case was actually in the courts. And the California, you know, appeals court said that their you know, their Prop 8 was not constitutional, and, you know, then that was the case that eventually went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court did not rule on the actual constitutionality of Proposition 8. What they ended up ruling was that the people who supported the proposition, who had taken this case to court, didn't have standing. And so, you know, they basically rejected the case, and they let the appeals court ruling stand, which reopened marriage in California.
Go ahead, Jason.
Just because the voters voted in an amendment to the Constitution doesn't make it constitutional. You know, this has happened, and it happened in California in 1964 with Proposition 14, where they voted in an amendment that basically allowed discrimination based on race for property owners and landlords. And the Supreme Court ruled later on in 1967 that too was unconstitutional. It had nothing to do with the will of the voters. It's, you know, if it's unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional, no matter if the legislature passes it or the people pass it.
Okay. This is a question for the two of you. When was the last poll that sort of gauged public opinion in Florida about gay marriage? And what did it have to say? Steve, do you recall? When was the last one?
There was a poll, I think, taken in February or March. I think it was the Quinnipiac poll, and it showed that now about 56% to 58% of the public support allowing gay people to marry.
Is that only in Florida?
Well, that was the Florida poll.
Uh-huh.
But you see, now that you still need to have 60% plus one in order to undo the constitutional amendment from 2008. So in order to take that to a popular vote, you need to again go above 60% in order to change the Constitution. Something I just would like to talk about, there is some breaking news in this story.
Please.
That is Attorney General Pam Bondi. She has, you know, basically filed a response to the couples here in Miami-Dade and Monroe counties who had asked that this case be sent directly to the Florida Supreme Court, and today Bondi's office released a filing that was sent late last night that she would prefer that this case not go to the Florida Supreme Court. She believes that the case will ultimately be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And so, you know, she wrote that, you know, neither the district appeals court nor the Florida Supreme Court can decide this federal issue with finality. And she said the U.S. Supreme Court, however, has the final word on the Constitution, and she expects that this case would go to the U.S. Supreme Court soon, based upon some filings this week from the states of Utah and Oklahoma asking that their cases go directly to the Supreme Court. The one problem with this is that the Supreme Court is not obligated to take the case.
Right.
So if the Supreme Court says that we're not going to hear this right away, that means that, you know, Florida then is still undecided. And, you know, basically, if it goes to the Florida Supreme Court and there is a ruling there one way or the other, and the Supreme Court says it's not going to take these cases yet, then it would be the Florida Supreme Court ruling that would ultimately decide the state, just as it did in California.
Okay, and one last question, and then we have to move on. Steve, we're seeing gay marriage become a major issue in the governor's race. The LGBT advocacy group SAVE has just endorsed Charlie Crist, based in part on his support of gay marriage. Jason, where do you see this issue going in the election, in the gubernatorial election?
Well, I think that, you know, as Steve pointed out, you know, a majority of Floridians do support gay marriage now. So this is a perfect opportunity for Charlie Crist to support it, because a majority of Floridians support it. But I think it's going to be a relatively non-issue in total, because I think Rick Scott is going to try to avoid it as much as possible. And Charlie Crist has already come out in favor of it.
Steve, do you agree?
Well, I think that Scott's trying to avoid it. But you do have Nan Rich, who's, you know, still in the primary race.
That's
she's
right.
Speaking about this. And in fact, yesterday, Palm Beach, you know, their gay rights group, they're the Palm Beach County Human Rights Council, they endorsed Nan Rich in the primary. Now, we've seen Charlie Crist receive endorsements from both Equality Florida and SAVE, which are the two leading gay rights groups in Florida. But, I mean, essentially, you know, Scott has not dealt with this. He has avoided talking about it as much as possible, and has really left it to Pam Bondi to have to be the public face of this in Tallahassee.
And I think it's important to point out that in Charlie Crist's evolution, you know, Save Dade basically said, compared him to President Obama, but I think the difference is that Charlie Crist actively opposed gay marriage in 2006, 2008, whereas President Obama never really actively opposed gay marriage. He just didn't quite support it.
Jason Parsley, associate publisher of the South Florida Gay News, and on the line we had Steve Rothaus of the Miami Herald. Thank you both.
Thank you, Chris.
And just a reminder to our listeners, you can join in the conversation. Please call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. Or you can always send us a tweet. Our call sign is at WLRN. Well, we are just a few weeks from the beginning of the school year. Actually, no, John O'Connor, school begins next week, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
Yeah. And
it's already started in some places.
It has already started. Florida students have some major adjustments to make. This year will be the first year the teachers in Florida will use the math and language arts standards known as Common Core. That's going to be for all grades, am I right?
That's all grades. They've had a test run the last couple of years in kindergarten through second grade, so the youngest kids have already started with it.
Okay, and he would know. John O'Connor is WLRN's education guru. So, John, I'm going to have you take out your number two pencil right now and tell us, first off, for those unacquainted with Common Core, what is it?
So, Common Core is a set of math and language arts standards that basically provides a roadmap for teachers of what kids should know at the end of every grade. When they design them, they started out by saying, all right, when we have a high school graduate, we want them to be able to do X, Y, and Z. And then they work backwards to kindergarten to build up to that point. The goal is to have kids who are ready for college level work, or to be able to find a job that you could support a family of four on by the time they graduate high school.
Are schools and teachers ready for this?
That's the big question.
This has been a major debate for a couple of years now.
Absolutely. And in the biggest districts, they have been preparing for several years. And so I would say that the big districts are probably pretty well prepared. Hillsborough County, Miami-Dade County,
And Broward County?
Broward County, yeah. Orlando, Orange County. Those districts have really been putting in a lot of time and money to train teachers. They've been talking about it. The teachers have been working together on lessons and techniques and things like that. The question is elsewhere. Some school districts, rural school districts, maybe have a little bit tougher time dealing with this, that they don't have as much money to put into teacher training and things like that. The other question is, once you get into this and you start trying to teach these lessons in these new ways, do things break down? And do you have principals who are willing to let their teachers kind of find their way with these things and learn on the job?
And, this is a sore spot for me because I had the most dynamic teachers growing up. They were so creative and wonderful with their lesson plans. Do these Common Core standards sort of usurp the authority of teachers to just put together, to get creative with their teaching?
The way teachers have described the change to me, the biggest change is that they say, the traditional method is that a teacher would get in front of a classroom and teach a lesson and then they call it the IUE kind of method, where the teacher demonstrates it, the class does it, and then they do it together. This new method, a lot of teachers say they kind of turn over the keys to the kids. So they have to design the lesson in a way that the kids can figure out the concept on their own, and that the teacher doesn't say, here's the concept I want you to learn, but the kids kind of to do the work on themselves together and come up, get to the final endpoint.
And last question, John, how do teachers feel about the exam? You've spoken to quite a few of them by now. What do they feel about about Common Core, period?
Well, teachers in general that I found like Common Core. They like the flexibility it gives them. The exam's another question because we haven't seen what the final exam is going to look like, this thing that they're calling the Florida Standards Assessment. We've seen some sample questions, but I think teachers are generally kind of concerned because they don't know what they're going to be facing next spring.
John O'Connor, he is WLRN's education reporter. John, A+.
Thanks.
Speaking of report cards, we've got a couple of people in our newsroom who get an A++. This summer, WLRN summer interns have been working together on stories about food in different South Florida cultures. And no matter where you are in the world, there's one ingredient so many cultures seem to have in common. It's rice. Jeffy Bernard and Carla Javier brought us into the kitchens of South Floridians from South America, the Caribbean, and Central America. Here is Patrice Baptiste from North Miami. She's fixing a traditional Haitian rice dish.
If I don't eat rice, it's like I'm not done. I have to at least have two or three spoonfuls of rice to complete my meal.
Baptiste soaks her mushrooms overnight to stain the water black, and that's what gives the rice its color.
I like to use the basmati rice because the basmati has less starch. Don't measure, we just don't.
I just love that. I love this lady. She just said, you don't measure, you just dump it, which, by the way, is the way my mama makes risotto. And you can hear the entire feature on WLRN.org. Many thanks and best wishes to all our interns, Jeffy Bernard, Constanza Gallardo, Carla Javier, and Salima Hussein. It has been wonderful to see the next generation of public broadcasters in action. We will miss you, ladies. And that's all the time we have for today's Florida Roundup for Friday, August 8th, 2014. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. And we post it on our website at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Julia Duba, Steph Farrow, Sammy Mack, and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Taryn Shepherd. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mayers. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. I'm Christine DiMattei. Thanks for listening.